ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jack McLennan was 27, fit and visibly strong.
He was trained well. He knew how to hit, and I was gobsmacked.
He seemed ready for anything, but then he suddenly vanished.
I was just talking to him last night. Like, how the hell does that happen?
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on Big Ideas, holding power to account and the toll it takes when your story becomes the story. You'll meet two courageous journalists, one locked in a Chinese jail for more than 3 years after espionage allegations. The other put on trial in what was to become one of the longest defamation trials in Australian history. What they endured beggars belief, but it didn't stop them believing in the role of journalists to unearth the truth. Welcome to ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Joining you from the stage of the 2026 Sorrento Writers' Festival on the Mornington Peninsula today, on the land of the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation. Charlotte Grieve is a multi-award-winning investigative journalist, formerly with The Age, Sydney Morning Herald and 60 Minutes, now with the ABC. Her new book is called Duty to Warn, Dr. Munjed Almedaris, Promised Hope, A Daughter Saw Danger, and fought for the truth, about a case which continues in court this week with an appeal. Cheng Lei is a Chinese-Australian journalist who's worked for both Western and Chinese media and is now a presenter with Sky News. Her book, Cheng Lei, A Memoir of Freedom, is an intimate account of being incarcerated by the Chinese government. After much diplomatic wrangling, Cheng Lei was released in 2024 and received the Press Freedom Award from the Australian Press Council that same year. Charlotte and Cheng Lei's stories are a real testimony to their tenacity and to their resilience. Let's meet them. You could have walked away from these stories. You could have got on with your life. You could have found peace in your heart. Instead, you decided to write these stories down and give us a precious book. Cheng Lei, why did you do that?
I think it's my duty now that I've lost so much. I can't go to China. When people from China talk to me, they're afraid. People are afraid to be in pictures with me, to be my friend. But losing everything also makes me fearless. So many people are afraid to talk about China, to be critical of it, to even do digging because of ties to China. And let's face it, who doesn't have ties to China in some way or another, and in our trade-dependent nation as well? So I'm in a really good privileged position to give a voice to the voiceless. And given that the Chinese government has made me and all of my personal life public fodder, you know, part of a disinformation campaign, they've made it all personal, then it is also my right to call out, well, actually just factually lay out what they did and explain why they do things like that.
So a clear purpose for you, a clear mission. Charlotte, what about you? Again, you could have, after surviving this case and supporting patient survivors to do the same, winning the case, you could have walked away and continued with your journalism.
Yeah, I wrote the book because I felt that there'd been some media coverage of the trial and obviously our investigative reporting in the papers, but I didn't feel like any of those stories did justice to the monumental experience that I went through and the 35 patients and their families went through. And so I thought writing the book was a good way to have all of these stories in the one place. And for readers to be able to realise that these aren't just names in a newspaper. These are real people with real lives who were really treated in some unbelievably shocking ways by their doctor and his lawyers. So as the title suggests, you know, I did feel that I had a duty to warn the public about this doctor, but also a duty to respect the people who spoke out.
And all of those patients had experienced untold suffering before they met this surgeon. This story for you starts with your dad, and this is where it gets personal. What happened to your dad, Don, in 1963, age 18?
Yes, so my father was 18 at the time. He was just starting out in life. He was a law student at Adelaide University, and he bought a motorbike to drive between his factory job and the university. And on the very day he bought that bike, he went tearing down a street in the city and crashed into the side of a parked car. He lost his leg below the knee and, yeah, he became an amputee. He's lived his entire life using socket prostheses, and he's been able to live an incredible life, very mobile, very independent. It's something that he's sort of guarded very strongly and been very proud of.
And become a leading Sydney barrister and had children, raised a family, so lived a very large life. Why? But alongside that, he was experiencing really nasty phantom limb pain, which is extremely debilitating. Why did he come to meet this doctor, Dr. Munjid Elmadaris?
Like many amputees, they put on a brave face, but they do live with, you know, huge amounts of pain. It varies from person to person, obviously, but my father dealt with phantom pain, as you mentioned, and that came in waves. It could come, you know, every day, or it could pass, you know, a few months and he would get it. And it was a really crippling pain. I saw it, he'd wince in pain. You know, it was all consuming. And he met Dr. Elmadaris at an event and asked him, you know, does your miracle surgery, does it help with phantom pain? And the doctor said, you know, you betcha, come and see me. And that started this series of events where Dad became fixated on getting this surgery, no matter the cost, no matter the risks. He was, really, really fixated on getting it.
There was a red flag early on in that conversation, though, wasn't there? Dr. Elmadaris gave your father a prediction about his condition.
Yeah, so not only did he say that this surgery will cure you of phantom pain, but he said if you don't go ahead with it, you will end up in a wheelchair by the time you turn 80 years old. My father was 75-ish at the time, and that was a really damning prognosis for someone who had lived decades and decades and fought very hard for his mobility. So that really shocked him.
Just give people a sense at this stage of what a superstar Dr. Elmadaris was and what the surgery was that he was providing people. And it was changing some people's lives. And he had an incredible story himself, which had really captured hearts and minds. He'd become a very powerful and effective refugee advocate, hadn't he?
He had. And I mean, I think in any patient-doctor relationship, there is a major power imbalance. Australians and people all around the world trust almost without question what their doctors tell them. But in the case of Dr. Elmadaris, that power imbalance was so much greater because by that point he had this enormous media profile, and not only his story was very powerful, but the success stories of his patients had been covered extensively. So in the public's mind, this surgery was a miracle, and there was no coverage of when it could go wrong. There was no mention of the risks involved often in the coverage. There was no disclosure that Dr. Elmadaris has a financial interest in performing the procedure on every patient.
He owned the patent on the technology.
He did, yes. So those kind of qualifying facts that might make patients think twice about this surgery were left out. And all that was left was this miracle surgery performed by this incredible man.
And what was the miracle surgery? It's quote called, unquote.
Yes, it's called osseointegration, and it's the process where titanium fuses with bone. Almedeiros became famous for using it on amputees, and essentially he would insert this titanium implant into an amputee's residual limb, which would protrude through the skin and connect to a prosthetic limb. Now, because there was this protrusion through the skin, there was a permanent open wound, and that became a vector for infection, which is where many of the problems for the patients who the surgery didn't work began with.
At what point did you go, there's a story here? How did you get the lead?
Well, my father didn't go ahead with the surgery because when he became so fixated on it, my mother sort of took note and said, look, why are you feeling like this? You know, you've walked around your whole life, you know, using your prosthetic. What's changed? And she encouraged him to get a second opinion. And in that second opinion, Dad was warned, do not go anywhere near this surgery. This man has a much higher complication rate than he lets on. And this person who gave him the second opinion said they had seen this underclass of patients for where the miracle surgery did not go well. And those patients had been left in crippling pain, often depressed and abandoned by their doctor. So that was the red flag.
Okay, we'll come back to that and we'll dive into some of those side effects, because those stories are extraordinary, and ultimately that led to the extraordinary court case that you were involved in. Cheng Lei, take us back to China, Beijing, 2020. You're living a great life, working with Chinese state media, emceeing major events, hosting a business show. It's a tricky year though, 2020, isn't it? But just give us a sense of what it was like for you as a journalist who'd worked in the West as well, working for Chinese state media, effectively controlled by the Communist Party.
I was an accountant in Australia and switched careers from counting beans to spilling beans in China. And when I joined the predecessor to Chinese state TV's English arm, I was quite optimistic that China would reform its media space. It was 2002, it joined the WTO. Everything was about internationalization and liberalization. And after I joined, about a year and a half after that, I left to work for US network CNBC for 9 years. And so when my old boss from the Chinese TV station called me to come back, I was still hopeful that China would actually free up its media sector more. But I guess when I went to China, I was kind of a beneficiary of China's internationalization. And when I became locked up, was becoming a victim of China's nationalization after Xi Jinping came into power. So my personal story was about to become part of the bilateral relationship story. And the fact that I still worked in state media at the time, I was actually getting ready to leave because everything was already becoming very politicized. We would have American economists or CEOs saying they couldn't come on my show, or people would tailor their messaging, say one thing on my show, say another on Bloomberg. And it was, it really started with Trump's first term. So at that moment, when China and Australia were deeply unhappy with each other, especially after Australia called for an independent investigation into the source of COVID, and everything about COVID I discovered in China was to be raised to the next level of state security, everything became a top secret. And China had also just locked up, like the day after our former Foreign Minister Maurice Payne called for that investigation, China locked up its Wuhan cleanup man, the deputy head of police, who just happened to have family in Sydney and had studied in Sydney. So in April of 2020, China started surveilling Australians in China.
Including you. You later found out 3 days later after that.
I found out more than
they'd started in surveilling you.
I found out 2 years later that that was when the surveillance started, because the timeline of a Chinese judicial process is very strange. Arrested in August 2020, trial in March of 2022, charged 6 months after I was arrested, and the trial went on for 90 minutes. Everyone just played their parts, read out their scripts. I pleaded to go to jail because that way I'd be able to have family visits. And in all that time, I only heard my kid's voice once. And that was after the bilateral relationship improved, after Australia changed governments. Albanese met Xi Jinping in Jakarta. 3 weeks later, I got a phone call, even though the Australian government had been lobbying for me to have that phone call for 2 years.
Take us back then to August 2020. You get some urgent text messages from your bosses. What are they and what happens?
So when you work in TV, you're used to a lot of rapid changes. Mm. And I was told to go into the TV station to talk about my new show. And I quickly went, not knowing it was a trap. Immediately, my phone and bag were seized. From that moment on, I was never alone. Even that day, going to the toilet in my own home, female officers, were watching. So they took me back to my apartment, raided my apartment, took away everything, and took me to a secret location, blindfolded. And at that time, I didn't know what I had done wrong. And I continued to not know that for months and months.
The horror of being locked in a Chinese jail without knowing why. Sky News presenter and journalist Cheng Lei, and at the time, her two young children were stuck in Australia, staying with her mum because China had closed its borders during the COVID pandemic. She joins me today with investigative journalist Charlotte Grieve, who's reporting on high-profile surgeon Dr. Munjed Almedaris was subject to a long defamation trial. This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, podcast on ABC Listen, and, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Natasha Mitchell. We're joining you from the 2026 Sorrento Writers' Festival with an audience at the Conti Hotel for the session When My Story Becomes The Story.
Tell us what then unfolded in, because for the first number of months you were in isolation, weren't you? So, and that was, you described that in the most visceral way. This is an extraordinary book to read. You really take us inside the interior of this experience over the 3 years. And those first months are alone, this endlessness of endlessness, as you describe it.
I don't think there is another system on earth that has this form of torture, because China is so well-resourced and yet so perverted in how it tries to break people psychologically, that it can invent this sort of isolation, in quotation marks, because I had two guards stuck to me for every minute of the day. They would change every 4 hours, but there were always two people watching me sit there for 13 hours, go with me to the toilet, watch me shower, watch me sleep. And
So alone but not alone.
It's actually worse than being alone, because you can't scream, you can't move, you can't talk, you can't make any noise, and they are always there with you, warring into your soul.
Mm. We're at a writers' festival, and the way you describe how books became this incredible salve for you is really beautiful. The way you used words, the way Cheng Lei took comfort in her imagination, in your imagination, is just a beautiful thing to witness, even in this horror. But the first book that the guards give you is called Glorious Suffering. It's a history of the Communist Party of China.
When I saw the book, I mean, when you're in that situation, to be given anything, much less a book, was a miracle. So, but then when I saw the cover and the title, I kind of went, is this part of their brainwashing? Do I really want to read this? But as it was, you're in such pain, and such desperate need of escape that you would read anything three times. You would read the, you know, seriously back, like cover to cover, even the tiny print that says, you know, the copyright and everything.
Yeah, you rationed your reading, those
you
precious
have to,
words.
Because otherwise you can't keep going for longer. So the first time I read that book was 600 pages in one day, which was a big luxury. But that means you don't have anything new to read for days, weeks. So later on, when I got a new book, I would carefully ration out for, you know, these 4 hours. I'm only going to read 27 pages. Then I'm going to stop. And in the morning, if I thought, oh, I've got some new chapters to get me through the day, that would fill me with hope.
Extraordinary that you also read Peter Greste's book of Being Imprisoned in Egypt and also Kylie Moore Gilbert's Imprisoned in Iran, are both Australians.
We've become good friends.
And also really spearheaded a bit of a movement together around Australians incarcerated overseas. But also along the way, in these days, weeks, months, hours and years, as it happened, you were being interrogated. What was that experience like?
Very strange and unsettling, because they would ask you everything, and they have everything. They have all of your electronics, and you feel that they can go and talk and coerce anyone that you've ever known and look at everything you've ever done. Mm. So you don't, you are naked. And everything that you want, whether it's, because you're not allowed to wear bras there, so whether it's a singlet top or whether it's a cushion for your bum, because it was starting to bleed because of all the sitting on the hard surfaces, or letters from your family. You relied on the officers. You are utterly alone. I didn't see my lawyer until 10 months and many confessions later. Mm. So what could I do but try to answer as honestly as I could? There is no real sense in rebelling or hunger strikes, I felt, because the system is what it is, and it is not going to yield to your pleas of innocence or how you suffer. And I wanted to, you know, come out still healthy for my family. So they would ask you about your grandparents. And that's another very strange thing about the Chinese system, that no family member is spared. Recently, we saw the father of a Hong Kong democracy activist who was prosecuted just for being the dad of somebody who was taking part in democracy activities. So you didn't really know where they were going half the time, and also what, you know, surveillance materials they already had, because they would have followed me for months already by that time.
And they were interrogating you about your colleagues.
Why did you go to this bar? What did you talk about at that restaurant?
Mm. Yeah, we'll come to your fortitude. I think that you had the self-awareness, and I guess as a journalist you do, because you know what happens to others inside Chinese jails, and sometimes it could go for years, sometimes it could go for a lifetime. So,
well, actually you don't, because not enough people are lucky enough like me to have the freedom and the platform to be able to talk about what goes on in those jails. So many people come out, they still have relatives in China, they still have to make a living somehow. Yeah. Like Stern Hu, the Rio Tinto executive, he's kept extremely quiet because he still goes to China for his family.
So it's a big decision that you've made to never be able to return, effectively. Well, hopefully you might be able to one day.
Well, I've come to the realisation that the way China is acting now, the closer you are its friend or acquaintance, the more of a prisoner you become to it.
Yeah, which it makes this opportunity to hear you talk today a really precious one. So thanks for telling this story. Charlotte Grieve, as you're reporting this story of Dr. Almodares's surgery, and yes, some of them work, some of them go terribly, terribly wrong, and you start investigating very deeply. It's an enormous story. What do patients start telling you? Describe some of the situations that they're dealing with.
Yeah, I spoke with so many patients all around Australia and all around the world. And I think one of the key things that joined all of them was just the unrealistic expectations that they had coming into the surgery. Many were told or believed that they thought it would be like having their leg back, having their old life back before becoming an amputee, which is a very vulnerable point to sort of tap into as an amputee. And when that went wrong, they weren't prepared for that fallout. So they weren't warned properly of the risks that they could entail. And some of those outcomes were beyond, you know, what the imagination could stretch as horror consequences. You know, I spoke with Mark Urquhart, a veteran who lost his ability to walk. Almadiris amputated both of his legs. He had his legs, but they weren't functional. Almadiris amputated both of his legs quite high, inserted these osseointegration implants in the hope of allowing him to walk. He had horror complications, everything from pain that was like a welder blowing on his legs to infections, rolling infections so severe he needed to be hospitalized and operated upon. He had on several occasions, this should often come with a trigger warning, but infestations of maggots in his legs. So really terrible outcomes there. And he was just one of many. But for Mark, the key thing with him was that his key complaint was that when he went to his doctor for help, he was dismissed or ignored or made to feel like this was your fault. You weren't managing the hygiene properly. So that feeling of being let down by his doctor was something also repeated by many patients.
And not being supported through the complications, because the reality is that maggots can infest a wound in this way, but they need to be managed, obviously. But he hadn't been warned of any of this. And this became a repeating pattern, didn't it? One of the most negligent cases, examples, is that of patient X. Who was patient X?
So patient X was, yes, a heartbreaking case who I learned of only briefly in my initial investigation by a confidential source who was a surgeon. And this surgeon had never spoken to a journalist before, had never, you know, even thought to contact the media. But he spoke to me out of sheer disgust and concern for patient X, who was a woman in her 30s. And she lived with severe anorexia. She also had a long list of other complications, including rolling infections, ulcers, non-healing ulcers. And she lost her legs from complications related to the anorexia.
And so a brutal situation.
She was very, very, very vulnerable. Unwell. And she had a pathological addiction to exercising. Yes, from her anorexia. And as a result of losing her legs, she could no longer run. And she met Dr. Almadiris, and he offered to perform osseointegration surgery on her. Her ambition was to continue running again.
And he knew that?
He knew that. And this surgeon who spoke to me said, you know, there's a difference between what the patient wants and what a doctor should ethically perform. And this surgeon thought, performing this osseointegration surgery on this anorexic woman who has so many comorbidities and is so unwell, only so she can continue her pathological addiction to exercising, was way outside the lines of what a responsible surgeon should do. So he told me about that. It turns out that there'd been other healthcare practitioners who had also raised alarm bells behind the scenes, tried to dissuade Dr. Almadiris from performing the surgery.
Was he receptive to being persuaded?
He said in the trial that he wasn't aware of the nature of some of these concerns. So it was an issue that came up extensively in the trial. And I only learnt the details of the extent of her unwellness through the trial. But yes, she was a particularly heartbreaking case.
Mm. This was an international effort. He was operating in Australia, but he was also operating overseas in war-torn countries, you know, it was a major, he was consulting in hotel rooms in America. Give us a, paint that picture for us, how big this was, how busy he was.
Yes, well, a prosthetist once described it to me as, you know, there are only so many amputees in Australia, and America was viewed as a very lucrative market for the expansion of this surgery. And court documents we obtained showed that he was making a net profit of $75,000 per patient he gave this operation to in America. So it was big business.
And people were, you know, struggling to find those funds to get this surgery, but such was their desperation.
That's right. And he wasn't licensed or registered to provide medical services in America. So he would go over to America and do these sort of road shows advertising the surgery and then lock patients into a contract whereby they traveled to Australia for the procedure and then they would be shipped back to America.
With their complications.
That was the problem, that there was no proper infrastructure for those patients when they went home. So often you had patients who were dealing with untold complications with this novel surgery that not many people know how to deal with. And these people would be turning up to emergency wards, you know, with blood dripping from the implant coming out of their leg. And the emergency wards would be turning them away saying, we can't touch that. But there was no process, there was no structure to help these people. And so that was another cohort of patients who felt really abandoned by their doctor.
Mm. Infections, maggots, inflammation, horrific pain. One woman had a drill bit still in her surgery site. Can you imagine? You're reporting this story very deeply. There's pushback because he had his own story of survival. He had escaped Iraq as a refugee, trained as a surgeon he'd been a surgeon over there. He'd escaped because allegedly he and other surgeons were being requested to amputate the ears of people who were betraying the army or trying to escape the army over there. So it was, you know, he had a big story to tell, and he was a refugee advocate because of his own story. And so he had a lot of, and the media had courted him. He had big profiles on the ABC and other outlets. You know, he was much loved.
Yes, his reputation was something that
people
he
pushed back, didn't they?
Yes.
Because of that.
Yes, yes. He'd spent a long time carefully curating this narrative that he told to the public, and that had the impact of raising the profile of his medical practice. Yeah, it wasn't just the ABC, it was, you know, from across the spectrum. He had such support, and no one questioned, you know, his story, no one questioned his surgery. And that was one of my key kind of reasons for writing Duty to Warn as well, because I think it was partly a failure on the media's part as well, because the story had such a narrative arc. It was easy to tell. It had good visuals of the bionic half man, half machine. And so journalists, you know, didn't ask the questions they needed to ask.
You did. It had consequences. You end up in the third longest court case in Australian history, is that right?
Defamation.
Defamation case. The longest time a journalist has presented in such
yes.
a case?
Yes, unfortunately the longest cross-examination of any journalist.
How long was
yes.
that?
It was 6 days in total.
Yeah, but the court case went for a long time. Take us inside that courtroom. There was deep discomfort putting patients on, in a sense. You had a duty of care to them, and now they were, in a sense, defending your reporting. And the interrogation that they receive, your description of this in the book is extraordinary. Sue Chrysanthu, who's one of Australia's top defamation lawyers, she's hard in a court situation. It was brutal, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the hardest parts of the whole experience, watching, you know, the people who entrusted me to tell their story up in the witness box for sometimes days on end, being subjected to interrogation, which in my opinion crossed many ethical lines. I do understand that, you know, truth must be tested, facts must be tested, evidence must be interrogated, but sometimes it went round and round in circles. Patients were brought to tears in the witness box. I heard one woman in the bathroom vomiting. One other patient was pushed so far to the extreme that he became suicidal. It was extremely difficult to watch, and you know, it really did make me question the value of the whole endeavor at various points. I thought, you know, if I've encouraged and empowered these people to tell their story and this is the end result, is this really in the public interest? But luckily, at the other end of it, the patients were all very empowered by telling their story.
All along the way, you were reluctant to explain that there was a personal connection to this story for you. And so that's interesting, that reluctance as a journalist. And you lean right into it in this book, so you've kind of released that story now. But also your father fronts up as well and appears in court as well on the dock. So how was that?
Yes, no journalist ever wants to insert themselves in the story. Unfortunately, we kind of had no option with this one. Once I received a legal letter early on in the case accusing me of having a conflict of interest because my father was a patient, I knew this was going to be a key line of attack.
Yeah.
So it's something that my father was very nonchalant about. He sort of, you know, agreed to be a witness, turned up in court.
Excellent witness.
Well, yes.
Leading barrister. He really put her through her ropes.
Yeah. I think he enjoyed it, strangely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I try to make the point in the book, and I think was ultimately vindicated by the judge, that Al Medeiros accused me of having this conflict because of my lived experience of having a father who is an amputee. But in my opinion, that actually made me a better reporter for this type of story because I understood the experiences of amputees, the vulnerabilities that they have, the various sort of, pain thresholds and surgeries and technical language that they understand. So I thought this, you know, supposed conflict actually informed my reporting and made it better. And it's an interesting discussion more broadly that's happening in journalism around how much of yourself should you bring to the job. And I think, you know, all journalists go through the same process of fact-checking, of verifying, of seeking out alternate perspectives, and that core part of the job will never change. But I hope that, you know, we can move to an area where lived experience is embraced as enhancing reporting.
This became a major test case, didn't it, for journalism, for maintaining the confidentiality of your sources. It was a very significant case.
Yes, it was the first time the public interest defence had been successful for the media. So there was a huge amount of responsibility, I felt. What was involved in that was testing whether the journalists had a reasonable belief that the stories were in the public interest. And I was in no doubt about that at all throughout the entire case. But what it did was it opened up what had been described to me as a royal commission into my journalism. Every single phone call I took, every single note that I wrote, every single email that I sent was subpoenaed and scrutinized. So yeah, it really kind of put my practice through a type of scrutiny that I think is unprecedented.
Did you start journalism in 2018?
Yes.
That was her first job, 2018. When was this court case?
2022.
2022. That is extraordinary.
Well, that was another big part of it. They sort of portrayed me as this naive, green, inexperienced.
Oh, you are not that.
A real baptism of fire. And investigative journalist Charlotte Grieve tells the full story in her extraordinary book, An Account of the Trial. It's called Duty to Warn. Dr. Munjed Al Medeiros promised hope, a daughter saw danger and fought for the truth. Natasha Mitchell here, bringing you this episode of Big Ideas from the 2026 Sorrento Writers Festival, also joined by TV journalist Cheng Lei, who is sharing her gruelling experience of being locked in a Chinese jail for 3 years and 2 months and what kept her sane.
Cheng Lei, back to you. In your own version of hell, a complex situation where you're not put to trial, at some point you come together with some other women in a cell. Your description of the relationship that you form with these women is really something else to read. And you ended up finding support by supporting them.
Absolutely, And they say that nurses and doctors often fare better in crises because they are so busy helping others that they actually do become more optimistic, and they're not whinging, they're not moping around, you know, crying into their porridge. So I found a lot of power and hope, positivity, just by my daily goal of making my cellmates smile or laugh, whether it's through teaching them dialogue from Fawlty Towers, which then my cellmate did in a Cantonese accent. I mean, if you can imagine that, John Cleese would be very, very amused.
The singing.
Yes, lots of daggy 80s songs, which we always sung surreptitiously because there are 5 cameras in the cell, as well as patrolling guards and officers above us. So we always had to be on the lookout and always determined to continue, even when we were told off or punished, and sharing books. The thing about that sort of cohabitation compared to what we understand of Western or other prisons is that it's extremely isolating. You are in a cell with 3 others. Sure, you have some human company, but you are with each other for every minute of every day. You are sharing the bed. It's a big, long bed, so you are sleeping centimetres away from each other. You know, burps, farts, toilet sounds, everyone getting sick, people being in a state of depression all the time, people with OCD always washing her hands. Mm. All these things are just relentless. You cannot escape for even 1 second because you are in this cell together all the time. The exercise yard is an extension of the cell, so you are still with the 3 others. And that means you cannot gossip about anyone.
No.
Unless they're in the toilet, in which case you have to make it fast or do it through your eyes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of eye rolling.
At what point did you come to understand what you were in there for? 7 minutes, an embargo.
Well,
but more than that.
Yeah. It's show me the man and I'll show you the crime. I've since come to understand the state security cases in China are often very porous. The evidence can be manufactured, testimonials can be coerced, and I don't know which is worse. In Russia, where they don't even bother with this justification or this veneer of legality, or China, which says it has the system of law, but everything is arbitrary, including my sentencing and, you know, the reason that I was surveilled was that I was corresponding frequently with foreign journalists. Now, as a foreign journalist, I had been doing that for 18 years.
It's called doing a job.
Yeah.
The basics.
And why was that reason for suspicion? And to this day, they are still making up lies about me, including about my family. Why is that?
Yeah. How did freedom come?
It all started to change after Australia changed governments. And this, again, coming back to the point of, is everyone a prisoner to China in some way or form? Because if we get this message that, okay, your people won't be arbitrarily detained if you have this supposedly more China-friendly government in power, is that not subtly influencing our politics? And including now, the coalition or the opposition is probably less likely to be openly critical of China, and especially behind closed doors. It's a very subtle mind shift that's something I'm very concerned about. When you start checking, oh, should I say that? Because China can easily be offended, and there are so many things it can be offended about: Tibet, Taiwan, Tiananmen, Uyghurs, Hong Kong. And then the consequences are so significant for the economy, for your people. And then, like right now, we have this case where a Chinese student at the University of Sydney who took part in democracy activities has now been sentenced to 6 years in jail in China after he went back after graduation. and the University of Sydney won't comment.
You had, I think, monthly meetings with the embassy staff, which was a significant comfort. You couldn't talk to your family for a very long time. Eventually you did. Take us then...
Once.
In the 3 years.
Yes.
Once.
Yes.
To your children.
Minutes. It was a huge performance. It was diplomacy. It was their benevolence. They're so kind for giving me 30 minutes.
You are released. Penny Wong at some point embraces you, I think.
At the airport,
which is a beautiful scene to see. The way that you write about your relationship to freedom now is really potent. What is your sense of life purpose? This is a woman who I think has jumped out of a plane, done a comedy show.
Got a diving certificate.
Well,
I was going to go for a swim in Portsea this morning, but then the timing didn't quite work.
Now is staging a play about her story.
Coming to you at North Melbourne Arts House at the end of May.
You are leaning right into life.
Despite being dropped by Rising Festival because they're worried about audit and risk review.
Oh, you're kidding
me. There is a Chinese state-funded exhibition as part of Rising, so...
Oh, no. That's unbelievable. What do you think about freedom now, after what you went through?
I obsess about it. I think about it in everything. I live with my mum and my two teenage kids, and sometimes I feel like I'm running an intergenerational correctional facility. About it. Whenever I say, I'm going to take your devices away, I'm the warder. You know, go to your room, that's solitary. And why do we send kids to schools? You know, if they go do 13 years in the same school, is that a 13-year sentence?
Yes.
You know,
I would say it is.
But very expensive
it,
one.
What was it like reconnecting with your children? They were very young, and then 3 years later, kids do a lot of growing up in that particular period of their life.
And to this day, I'm quite saddened that things with them and in them are never going to be the same had I not been taken away from them. Mm. For example, my daughter is super independent and she's very afraid of showing her feelings. She doesn't do hugs anymore. Mm. And she had to go to boarding school. And the irony is that she was in the same boarding house as the granddaughter of a former Chinese leader. So think about that, a system that locks up the mother of one child and then, you know, for all their claims that China is wonderful, sends their own offspring overseas to this other country.
But she's watching her mother become this amazing, outspoken advocate. Channelling...
Teenagers don't care about that.
No, they don't. But they do.
Later they will.
But they will.
They just laugh at everything mum does, except for her jokes.
Yeah, look, you're right in the teen years now. In 5 years' time, she will look back and go, oh, my God, this is my mother.
Okay, can I have that in writing, Natasha?
Yes. I'll sign it. We all will. I'm not a parent of a teenager. Is anyone? Yes, you know. You've seen it. Charlotte, in the time that we have, you won this trial. Your team won this trial. It cost your newspaper $10 million.
Yeah, counting.
And counting. 35 people, patients, represented their stories in this court case. How do you reflect on this experience now? Because Dr. Almodiris is still representing his story. I just Googled him and he was presenting from Florida. New practice.
Yes. So he has appealed our judgment and that will be heard in June this year. So the fight goes on. After our judgment came down in our favour, he released a statement on social media that said, I'm very disappointed with the federal court and I will be appealing. He said his ambition was never to, you know, overrule the truth. He just thought it was unfair reporting or something along those lines. But the thing that really stood out to me from that statement was just the lack of any acknowledgement again of the pain that he's caused to his patients.
His performance in court was extraordinary in relation to that. He washed his hands of the pain. I'm not a pain specialist.
Yes, he said he got very good at explaining what he wasn't. He said, you know, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a pain specialist, I'm not these things. And that was this deflection technique to not take accountability for his patients. These were people that he had operated on and he had promised that they would be connected for life, and he really failed them. And so he still seems to be living in this fantasy of him being, you know, unfairly treated, when it's actually his patients that he's unfairly treated.
You continue to interrogate and report on the health regulator, which is a big part of this story, and lack of action thereof. You continue to report on other medical stories where negligence is part of it. What's your message to all of us as future patients or current patients?
Yes. I mean, I always say that I would love to not have to write these stories. If the medical regulation was working in this country, problems with Dr. Almadiris' practice would have been picked up, you know, more than a decade ago, and hopefully ironed out so he didn't harm all of these people. But the reality is the world in which we live and the industry is hideously opaque. A doctor can have dozens of complaints made about them that are substantiated, that get settled behind closed doors, and there's no trace of that. They can have dozens of medical negligence cases brought against them where serious wrongdoing is found, but money is paid, and again, it's settled behind closed doors and there's no trace. So I think the public is really in the dark a lot of the time about the quality of medical care that they're getting. And the reality is, you know, the majority of doctors in Australia are highly qualified, do care about their patients, but that lack of transparency is really worrying. So my key piece of advice to people is always get a second opinion, always ask for independent medical research, particularly if a doctor is recommending a novel procedure that they may or may not have a financial interest in.
Yeah.
Ask those questions, because you cannot put blind faith in the healthcare industry.
Surgeons are fallible and they have big egos, and that gets complicated in relation to our medical care. Tenacious, courageous, extraordinary stories. I commend both of their books to you. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of your festival. Please thank our two guests.
Thank you, Natasha.
Joining me at the Sorrento Writers' Festival, journalist Charlotte Grieve, who is now with the ABC's Investigations Unit, and author of Duty to Warn, Dr. Munjed Almadiris Promised Hope, A Daughter Saw Danger and Fought for the Truth. The surgeon's appeal against the defamation case is in court this week. Cheng Lei is a Sky News host, and you can read her story in her book Cheng Lei, A Memoir of Freedom. Both extraordinary books. Next on the show, Zoe Daniel and Tom Woodruff on what it will take to win Middle Australia, the hip pocket politics of climate action.
I saw you speak at an event a couple of weeks ago with Cristiana Figueres, who was the absolute gun diplomat who led the Paris climate negotiations and delivered that. And I subsequently, through some really strange connections, ended up at a Buddhist mindfulness retreat with her for a week, which was extraordinary and not something I would normally do. But there was a lot of learning and there was a lot of discussion around these issues, and it really bears thinking around whether we went in the wrong direction as people who wanted to execute this change based on a moral and environmental standpoint. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, we've lost a lot of people because they haven't been able to grapple with how it will benefit them, their community. We've allowed division to percolate into those communities that has been fermented by the fossil fuel industry to protect itself. Mm-hmm. We have seen Donald Trump pull out of the Paris Agreement twice, so fragmenting that process and scaffolding, if I could call it that. And we now have One Nation in this country similarly fermenting division based on the frustration of these communities who feel that no one is listening and that they're going backwards, not forwards.
That's next on Big Ideas. Find Big Ideas episodes on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review too. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. Love hearing from you. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.